You're always balancing, especially in macro, timeliness of information versus relevance of information. Earnings season is highly relevant information,
Not
not
very timely.
particularly timely. But you do get tidbits in that can be very worthwhile. So, for instance, just yesterday, ZipRecruiter, which is online job postings, they noted that they've started to see a weakening in the growth of new open positions. Now, is that a foolproof employment's about to fall off cliff? No, but it's an incremental information that what looked super strong may be starting to ease. I think the big picture takeaway is that so far the economy's been relatively resilient, right? But I think the other really important takeaway is it's a very different economy than what we've been used to in the last 15 years.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And back on the podcast for a second time by popular demand, Daniel Krause. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm great, Darren. How are you?
Great. Terrific. Thanks for coming back on. Daniel is, well, he's one of my favorite New Yorkers because, you know, firstly, because he's so understated. He's the co-founder and a partner at Blue Door Asset Management. Prior to that, he was a macro analyst at Omega Advisors, and before that, an equity research analyst at UBS. And as I think I said last time, is one of the smartest macro thinkers that I know. And given that we are wrapping up corporate earnings season in the United States, it seemed that this was a really consequential earnings season, and thought we'd ask Dan to give some of his views about how that's played out. And the reason that it's such a consequential season is because with 2022 being a year where interest rates were pushed up dramatically, you know, there is this ongoing question as to what extent this is impacting the profits of companies, because that, of course, then impacts employment, which then impacts back to inflation, which is the thing that everybody seems to be most concerned about. So, Dan, give us a brief overview of what we've learned in corporate earnings season so far.
Okay, so looking at 4Q22, earnings came in down about 2% year over year. Now, this compares with 7% growth in nominal GDP during that period. To see negative 2% on earnings and positive 7% in nominal GDP is actually quite unusual. And it really emphasizes the importance of not just looking at the absolute growth rate, but the components that make up that growth rate. So, for instance, if we had 7% nominal growth and 5% of that was real and 2% was inflation, the historical relationship would imply that earnings would have been up in the mid-teens, right, based on what we've seen historically. But when so much of the rise in GDP is inflation, it negatively impacts margins. And so putting numbers to that, revenues were up close to 6% in the fourth quarter of 22, while earnings were down 2%. And so you can see a very clear hit to margins profitability over that period. Now, we can slice this several different ways. Right. So if you look from an industry perspective, you know, what's happening beneath the surface is that certain industries that benefit from inflation, like energy, earnings were up 60%.
Right.
Industrial earnings were up significantly. They were up more than 20%. On the other side, consumer discretionary saw an 11% decline in earnings. Technology saw a 9% decline. And financials saw a 10% decline. And so there's a very large bifurcations underneath the index headline. Another way to slice it is that industries that came out of COVID over-earning have really seen a significant hit to their bottom line, whereas the industries that were under-earning for years heading into COVID have now seen a shift that has helped them and helped them be more resilient on the earnings. And so there's a few implications of this. Implication number one is when you listen to commentators talk about earnings season, it's very much a choose-your-own-adventure, right? There's something there for everybody.
I remember those books. I had them as a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you want to talk about how negative earnings were, you could talk about the margin degradation. You could talk about discretionary being down 11%, financials down 10%. If you want to talk about how resilient earnings have been, you'll look at industrials that have done quite well. I think the bottom line is that there are the implications of the rising inflation rates are being felt. The energy, not a great indication on what's going on, right? Because they are the obvious beneficiaries. The industrial side is still benefiting. In fact, the part of the economy that is the last ones that are still benefiting from the fiscal stimulus. There's a lot of infrastructure and green energy stimulus sure. and incentives to manufacture domestically. And so that creates kind of a less rate and inflation sensitive form of spending. And it's a big reason why their demand has held up so well. So there's a lot of dynamics beneath the hood, but you know, the bottom line is we're starting to see those effects on margins.
Right. So the bifurcation is between more cyclical sectors on one side versus, you know, the more sort of standard, boring energy, industrials, et cetera, on the other, what you might call value sectors. And then the second bifurcation that you're pointing out to is between the COVID beneficiaries and really just reversion for both the COVID beneficiaries and maybe the ones that didn't, as spending shifts away from those sectors back to where maybe it would have been once upon a time.
Yeah, and it's important to note that those bifurcations both have something to do with the shift in stimulus being towards certain areas and away from others. So initially, the stimulus was all consumer-driven, and consumer discretionary and tech all benefited big from that.
Give people lots of money, let them spend it.
Exactly. And then you have now the stimulus is more industrial-driven, and so now you're seeing earnings growth shift in that direction. Right. So we're seeing those bifurcations play out.
And that's before the CHIPS Act really starts to throw money into the economy.
That's even before the CHIPS Act. But the infrastructure that was passed a couple of years ago, that's coming through. You are seeing, like, the Inflation Reduction Act is having some...
Okay, and where are we feeling the impact of interest rates? Where has that been focused most?
So I think first, anytime you're asking that question, you got to start with the most sensitive sectors to interest rates, which is housing. And housing volumes are down pretty materially. Now, that's both supply and demand driven, right? People are locked into their homes. If you got your mortgage at 3%, you're not moving, right? And so volumes are kind of naturally depressed because of that. Interestingly, it's helped to some extent home builders because the only homes being bought are new homes because nobody's moving out of their existing homes.
First homes.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's an important area to see that volumes are falling both from the supply side, but also from the demand side. Affordability is just simply well above or below, depending on how you want to say, but unaffordable, more so than we've seen in many decades. And so interest rates are definitely being felt. Now, the rising interest rates have not yet hit the most important sector of the economy, which is employment. And there are many reasons why this may be the case. One is excess savings that has propped up demand. One is labor hoarding because it was so hard to get labor for so long.
Yep.
But the bottom line is that rates have not yet impacted employment. That's something that may or may not be on the horizon. I think there are signs in both directions for that. But the rise in interest rates is tightening conditions. And I think that's the main takeaway. Regardless, now there's offsets to that, right? There's fiscal around the world. Europe's spending a lot on fiscal. China's stimulating a lot, right? So there are offsets that are happening. And those may create actually a short-term boost to growth. But ultimately, it will likely come back to that tightening that's happening in the rate areas.
Right. So if revenues are up 6% and earnings are down 2%, what that tells you is that companies aren't, in aggregate, able to pass on all of their additional costs onto their customers. Are we starting to see any adaptation by companies to that? Are companies retooling? Are they cutting headcount? Is there anything, or is that still in front of us?
Well, what's interesting is the companies that are seeing the margin hits have been the industries that have been cutting headcount, that being consumer and tech. So you are seeing retooling, and that's actually a really important point because there was a lot of concern. Would these big tech companies actually cut costs when needed? And the answer has been a resounding yes. They've absolutely been doing so. And so you're seeing companies adapt as they always do. It's what companies do. I would argue that's why equities outperform over the long term, because companies are the only asset that can adapt, right? Oil is always just oil.
Land is just land.
Exactly. So they're doing what they do. On the other side, there's certain things that are forced upon them that is very hard to adapt to. And that's things like labor costs rising. And so high wages, especially wages when unit labor costs exceed consumption growth, right? And so when your labor cost growth exceeds consumption growth, it's hard. It's hard because you can't just cut employment if you want to maintain your volumes. And companies are hesitant to cut employment right now because it's been so hard for them to get employees over the last couple of years, as we mentioned earlier. And so that's put them in a little bit of a box. The typical is that when margins fall, ultimately employment gets hit. I expect that typical reaction function will ultimately occur. If margins do continue to get hurt through labor costs remaining high, labor will eventually get hit. I don't see this as a, you know, some kind of long-term paradigm change. But in the meantime, in the short term, they're accepting those higher wages because they have no choice.
So you're saying the areas of the economy which have been most hit, tech and consumer, they have actually started to shed jobs. But we didn't see that move through the entire economy into other areas because they're still benefiting from stimulus and they're worried to lose employees that they just can't get back. But that, if I'm understanding what you're implying, that's likely to come over the coming quarters.
Yeah, I think that the margins continue to get hit. I don't think we've got a paradigm change. Eventually, those companies will cut. Now, if China's stimulus comes out super strong, Europe comes back and continues to stimulate, if for whatever reason the Fed were to ease rates, which I don't see happening, then certainly there are mitigating factors that could prevent us from ultimately seeing job losses. But I think the path that we're currently on is one that historically leads to those job losses, and it becomes a question of timing.
Okay, so if you sort of summarized it, what has earnings season told you about the state of the U.S. economy?
So I think it's important for us to note that earnings season, in general, is a bit of a lagging indicator, right?
What the economy was like back in October, November time.
Exactly, and you're always balancing, especially in macro, timeliness of information versus relevance of information. Earnings season is highly relevant information, not
very
particularly
timely.
But you do get tidbits in that can be very worthwhile. So for instance, just yesterday, ZipRecruiter, which is online job postings, they noted that they've started to see a weakening in the growth of new open positions. Now, is that a foolproof employment's about to fall off cliff? No, but it's an incremental information that what looked super strong may be starting to ease. I think the big picture takeaway is that so far the economy has been relatively resilient, right? But I think the other really important takeaway is it's a very different economy than what we've been used to in the last 15 years. And the way I would term that is that what we were used to is slower nominal GDP growth, right? Everybody was talking about this kind of lower trend growth environment that we were in for, you know, 2008 through 2020. Slower nominal GDP growth, but with actually fairly strong earnings growth during that period. And the reason for that was margins expanded beyond what many thought was possible. Right, because the U.S. economy became a lot less capital intensive, right, which shifted the weight of the index toward higher margin tech companies. This year's earnings have been the precise opposite. Margins have been the clear culprit for earnings weakness, and the highest margin companies actually were the most vulnerable. And so, like I said, there's a lot of bifurcations underneath the index, but I think the key point is that while the economy has been resilient, it's shown itself to be a very different economy than what we were used to.
What does that mean for the future? So does that mean that the U.S. is, you know, you see emphasis now on local manufacturing, CHIPS Act we mentioned before being a prime example of that, and infrastructure, both highly capital-intensive efforts. Is that what we should expect going forward, that we start to see, on average, the economy be higher, more capital intensive, lower earnings growth, even if we move to eventually a high GDP growth?
I think whether it's lower earnings growth or higher earnings growth, frankly, very much still remains to be seen. I think there's a more important factor here, and that is the difference between a fiscal stimulus regime and a monetary stimulus regime. And so if we go back, the last 40 years have been monetary stimulus. We had periods of fiscal stimulus during recessions, but in general, it's been very monetary stimulus dominated. And it's important to understand the mechanisms of monetary stimulus. So number one, everybody knows economics 101, interest rates fall, it's stimulative to the economy, right? It makes all future projects more profitable. What I think is underappreciated is that when interest rates don't just fall, but they're constantly falling to a new low, it is exponentially more stimulative because it doesn't just make every future project more profitable. It makes all your past projects more profitable because you refinance your cost of capital to a lower level, right? And so we went through 40 years of that kind of stimulus. What happens with monetary stimulus is that the central bank provides capital to markets, either through lower interest rates or through direct liquidity, and the market allocates that capital. And that's an important point. Market allocates that capital towards the highest return on invested capital opportunities. And so what you saw over the last—
Particularly if they're CLOs.
Right, exactly. So what you've seen over the last 40 years is that you had a secular rise in the return on invested capital. So from 1950 to early to mid 80s, return on invested capital was really just in a range around the economic cycle. just kind of mean reverted. And then mid 1980s till now, we've seen a secular rise. At the same time, we were seeing a secular fall in the cost of capital, right? And what drives investment returns? Ultimately, what drives investment returns is the value creation equation. It's what's your return on capital less your cost of capital, right? And so for 40 years, we had a secular rise in one side of that equation and a secular fall on the other. And so it was widening from both sides. That era, I believe, is behind us, right? And that doesn't mean it has to, both sides now have to contract on us, right? I think return on invested capital is likely to now be in a range rather than secularly rising. And cost of capital is likely to be in a range as well. That's a very different environment. In a fiscal stimulus dominated environment versus monetary, what happens is the opposite, right? Whereas in monetary, the central bank provides capital to markets and markets allocate it. In a fiscal stimulus environment, the markets or the central bank provides money, capital to the government and the government allocates it. And the reason that that's so important is because the government's not allocating it based on the highest return on invested capital projects. They're allocating based on the highest political return on capital project, which by definition is going to mean a lower ROIC environment than what we've seen, or at the very least, a no longer expanding ROIC environment like we've seen. And so when we talk about earnings growth, I think it's as important to understand that it's less about the growth rate of earnings and more about how much capital is it going to take to create those earnings. And in a fiscally stimulative scheme, that return on capital is likely to fall. And so what happens is instead of being in a lift all boats environment of the last several decades, there are going to be parts of the economy that are benefit from fiscal, right, that see positive incremental return on capital, and parts of the economy that see negative incremental returns on capital. And that's going to create huge divergences in where investment returns come from and kind of who's successful and who's not. Whereas, again, the last several decades, either you did really well or you did well.
So you're saying we move away from Fed put, which just means that the more leverage you can take, the more money you can make, to a position whereby investors need to think less about leverage and think more about where the government is putting its dollars and to follow.
And in general, there will be periods where, you know, the fiscal is less stimulative or more stimulative, right? So there, in any new regime, there's always periods of cycles happening. But I think getting away from what we've been used to, which is this lifting all boats and earnings growth, growth is what dominates, right? It's about the incremental change in return on invested capital and looking for drivers. In some cases, those drivers may be innovation, right? It may not be in all cases that it's fiscal stimulus. But I do think in all cases, the companies with highest incremental return on positive return on capital are going to far outperform those with the negative ones. And for the first time in decades, we will have a lot of companies that see both sides of that spectrum.
So as in, you know, thinking in terms of investment allocation and where dollars should be put, it sounds to me like what you'd be recommending in that type of a world would be perhaps a smaller focus on things like real estate and later stage private equity, where really, you know, which is a huge part of the play, and more of an emphasis on perhaps smaller, growthier type businesses with fundamental growth and areas like big capital projects, maybe green energy, those types of things where the government's going to be putting its wallet.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nuance, right? I think free cash flow generation is the key, right? So the smaller, growthier companies that are unprofitable are generally plays on liquidity, on monetary stimulus, right? When there's a lot of liquidity, those guys get a lot of it. So unprofitable tech, they'll have big rallies and big falls, but I would steer clear of that. When we think about, you know, areas that we like, things like developed market outsourced manufacturing, things like utility scale solar, supply chain solutions. So things like that are likely to be taking share for years. We think those are likely under-earning their long-term trend. There are other areas that have benefited predominantly from things like monetary stimulus. One example is the home improvement space, right? Home improvement right now, home improvement spend is by far the highest percent of income that it's ever been. And that has been a huge beneficiary of consistently falling interest rates. And so they are likely an area that's overearning over the long term. And so differentiating between, there's a lot of macro views right now, as it's right. Soft landing, it's hard landing, it's inflation going crazy, inflation's coming down, all the different views you can imagine. And to me, I have views on those things, but at the end of the day, who cares what my view is? What we care is, how does it translate to an investment? We're not trying to figure out the economy for the sake of the economy. And so to me right now, it's about finding what are those areas that are under-earning and avoiding the areas that are over-earning. And it's about understanding kind of what we discussed best on the inflation podcast, which is scarcity of assets. Where do you have scarcity and where is there going to be a need? And kind of how that trends by avoiding the places that are over-earning, just doing that, right, will be massively beneficial to the portfolio. In terms of your point on real estate, you know, I'll go back to kind of something we discussed on the other podcast also, which real estate has two aspects to it. Real estate as a trade and real estate as an investment. And so real estate as a trade was you buy the real estate, and if you were really smart,
you flip it.
Right, exactly. If you're really smart, there was value creation and you got the interest rates falling, and great, it did great. If you weren't all that smart, you just got interest rates falling. So great. So it was a win-win. That to me is over. Real estate as a business, though, can still be quite profitable. I think that the key, especially for individual investors, thinking about asset allocation, thinking about long-term right now, is to really identify what your advantage is in the marketplace. So for some individual investors, that's knowledge of a specific industry. For some, it's access to credit. And for others, it's just the ability not to have to chase short-term returns. And I wouldn't underestimate that last one. I think over the coming years, there's going to be lots of opportunities to both make money and lose money, depending on the industry. But I think what's most important to understand is being a provider of capital when capital is scarce can be very lucrative. And we haven't had a scarcity of capital in a long time.
Yeah.
But it involves being willing to miss out on those short-term opportunities and staying focused on kind of underwriting good, solid, multi-year risk rewards. And I think in doing so, there's going to be a lot of opportunities there, whether it's real estate or otherwise, if you're finding areas where you're being paid to be that provider of capital.
Yeah, which is actually, if you think about it, from you're a hedge fund guy, you've come from that world, that's probably a more attractive environment for you to be operating in than we've had probably for 20 years. As so hedge fund trades got crowded and chips all rose and all fell, just depending on what the Fed was doing on any given afternoon.
Yeah, no, I think there is the fact that there's going to be and has been a lot more bifurcations, frankly, has already begun to benefit us.
Yeah.
And so I think that'll continue to be the case. I think it can be dangerous to get too locked in on one view, right? It's markets move in wild swings.
Yes,
and so
they
you
do.
Want to, you got to have multiple views of things, like I said, over-earning, under-earning, things, you know, where the cycle is and all of that. And you lay that out across a portfolio, it can be very powerful.
Very cool. All right. Well, Dan, thank you very much. I should have said this at the beginning. It's the 22nd of February. So when we're recording this, it'll only go out a few days after. This may be slightly dated, but probably not too much. And Dan, your analysis is as sharp and as interesting as ever. So really, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me, Dan.
All right. And look out for more podcasts coming your way soon. And thanks to our producer and to everybody on the team. Okay. Bye-bye.